Okay. Well, as I said, we'll keep the questions slightly abridged, but the first one does relate to pretty much how it's written in the bigger sense about Sandra Lang's biography. And I wanted to ask you that she mentioned in an interview that it was in the interview broadcast on the BBC, there was something to suggest that the film was to be made out of this. What was it in the interview that prompted you to think there'd be a film within this?
I was in my kitchen one morning listening to Radio 4, as I often do, and I heard a trail for the story of a woman called Sandra Lang. And I was immediately intrigued because they didn't say very much. They said it's the story of a black woman born to two white Afrikaners during South Africa. Well, that immediately piqued my interest. The interviewer was a man called Peter White, who is the disability correspondent for the BBC. And he was in South Africa doing, as part of a program called No Triumph, No Tragedy, which was about the particular forms of prejudice experienced by the disabled. He heard of Sandra's story and thought, how can I make this fit my program? Because it's so extraordinary. And he decided that he could frame it in terms of under apartheid, being black was actually worse than being disabled. So he's a very good interviewer because being blind, he knows just the sort of questions to ask somebody for an audience that can't see. And I listened to this interview with growing amazement at all the twists and turns of the story. And within a few minutes, I was moved to tears. And when a story grips you emotionally like that, you know that it has the potential, that kind of human drama has the potential to become a movie. So that was, as a filmmaker, my immediate reaction to the story.
Actually, the next question actually is something that really intrigued me, because I know that you are a documentary filmmaker by tradition. What was it that wanted you or inspired you to make a drama as opposed to a documentary?
My background as a filmmaker is as a documentary filmmaker, but also I've made a lot of short dramas because it's always been my intention to move on to feature films. And one has to find the right subject matter to be able to do that. It's often a very long process, going from an idea to actually realizing it and making a film. So you've got to find an idea that's really going to sustain you over that long period of time. When I heard Sandra's story, I knew that there was the potential to make a documentary, but there were already two documentaries that had been made about her. The first was in 1977, seminal documentary by a man called Anthony Thomas, The Search for Sandra Lang. And that's an absolutely brilliant documentary that's been used all around the world as a teaching tool. But it only took the story so far. Another documentary was made by SABC, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, in 1998. And that brought the story more up to date, but it was a much shorter piece. And it didn't actually have what I felt was the dramatic conclusion of the story, which was Sandra reuniting with her mother after a separation of 27 years. So I felt that the story had all of the elements that could become a drama. And the reason I chose to pursue it as a drama rather than as a documentary was twofold. One, as I say, there have been two other documentaries already made. Secondly, feature films are, in a sense, the greatest communicators in our world today. More people see feature films than see documentaries. So in terms of reaching as wide an audience as possible, which every filmmaker wants to do, it seemed to me that a feature film was the way to go with this story.
Given the fact that if you're looking at a sort of a documentary, there might be categorical sort of events and timelines and sort of within that, as a drama, one can act in a way that leaves it open to artistic interpretation. How much of that have you placed in the film? And do you regret sort of adding in extra bits or leaving certain bits out? You know, how much are you playing with the story?
when you're making a feature film based on a true story, you have to make decisions about what you're going to leave in and what you're going to take out. Because in this case, we were telling a story that spans 30 years within an hour and 45 minutes. So what you're trying to do is to find those elements of the story that that hang together cohesively as a single piece of drama. And, of course, you're also looking for the most dramatic moments in a life. In Sandra's case, there were a huge number of dramatic events, so there was a lot of culling to do. In terms of creating fictional elements within that story, I used a principle. I don't like the idea of inventing material when you're dealing with a true story. I think that an audience often feels cheated if there are things in a true story that are not true and they're sold as true by the film. On the other hand, you also have to serve the master of drama when you're making a feature film, because if you told a story as it really happens, people would be walking out in droves. They'd be very bored. So my principle in terms of what I would and wouldn't include was as follows. Anything that I knew to be true in the story was allowable and could be used in the script selectively. Where we didn't know whether something could or could not have happened, it was also allowable. In other words, there was a degree of conjecture that I felt was morally acceptable because we couldn't know that it wasn't true. So in other words, I never deliberately put something in the film that I knew was not true. On the other hand, there are things in the film which act as sort of ligaments between scenes or in terms of the character arcs of the story, which were the result of conjecture. And I will explain perhaps later when I explain the process of how the script came about, how those conjectures were arrived at.
By the definitions of any culture, race, if it's not clear-cut, is ambiguous. Sandra's case was never the, you know, was more so true. How do you think this affected both her relationship with white people and also black people?
When Sandra was a little girl, she lived in a rural area cut off from the white community. Her parents were shopkeepers who served the local black community, which was a township about a kilometre away. So she lived in a sort of Eden where all her friends were black kids. She spoke fluent Zulu and Swazi because they were near the Swazi border, near Swaziland. And it was a period where she wasn't particularly aware of what colour she was. Her parents were white, and she was brought up as their white little girl. But they knew that they wouldn't be able to keep her at home forever. She would eventually have to go to school. The situation was complicated. In South Africa, under apartheid, white children and black children were not allowed to attend the same school. But Sandra's birth certificate said that she was white, so the parents had a legal basis on which to put her into that school. And they hoped that, despite the fact that she didn't look white, the school and the children would come to accept her, just as they no longer saw her as black. In terms of her own perception of herself, this was the first time that she ever realized that she was different. You asked me earlier in what ways we change the facts of the story to accommodate cinema. In reality, Sandra went to school at the age of 6, as any child would, 6 or 7. In our film, we didn't want to have different actresses playing the little girl. So we chose to make her a little bit older and for the school experience to be the first time she goes to grown-up school, if you like, no longer primary school. So Sandra was suddenly confronted for the first time with the fact that she was different. And yet she had been brought up to believe that she was white. So first she would argue with the kids that she wasn't black. And bit by bit, her sense of self began to change because the outside world was telling her that she was black. She was expelled from that school. It became a legal issue whether she was white or black. And her sense of self and belonging evolved over those years of her early teens, where more and more she felt accepted by black people, but not accepted within the white community. So, in a sense, her journey is very much one towards acceptance and belonging, and a sense of her own identity. You could say that she didn't belong in the black world any more than she belonged in the white world, because she was, her parents were white, and she was brought up as a white little girl. And it's true that she had to adapt to a lot of the cultural differences that existed within the black community, as well as ways of living that she hadn't been familiar with. There was no running water, for instance, in the township where she went. There was no sanitation when she gave birth. She didn't give birth in a hospital. But it was easier for her to accept these, if you like, more primitive ways of living, because she felt accepted by the community, and that was very important to her.
Has she seen the film, and what was the impact on her?
Sandra has been very involved with the film project from the beginning. She's always wanted to know what stage we'd reached and so on. And when we actually came to make the film, we also invited her to come to the set as often as was practical. And halfway through production, we decided to screen an assembly of all the cut material, which at that point was almost an hour long. It was quite a lot of the story. And Sandra came along to that screening and watched with the cast and the crew. And at the end of the screening, somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, "You'd better go to Sandra because she's in tears." So I went over to Sandra and she was sobbing, and I wasn't quite sure how to react, and I wasn't sure whether that was joy or sorrow. And the little girl who plays Sandra at the age of 10, Ella, came up to Sandra and said, "Oh, don't be sad. Can I get you a drink?" And off she went. And she came back and she patted her on the shoulder and she said, "What did you think of my performance?" And suddenly Sandra started to smile and laugh and come out of her sorrow. And we asked her how she felt about seeing her life portrayed in this way, and she said that she felt the film was very, very beautiful and that it was painful to revisit all of these different traumas of her life, but at the same time she felt great relief at seeing them. So there was a catharsis for her.
That's actually linked into my next question, actually, so I won't ask that directly, but except that, is there a feeling that she might feel now that the film has come too late for her as a growing up, but that will have some benefit for other people to see this film?
When I set out to make this film, I had really two goals in mind. One was, of course, to make a feature film that lots of people would go and see. The second goal that I had was a very strong sense that Sandra, that there was some form of restitution that needed to be made to Sandra, that she had suffered a lot through no fault of her own, and that there was some reparation that was needed. And Sandra's rehabilitation through the last nearly 8 years that it has taken to make the film has been really a wonderful and heartening process that has gone on in parallel with the creation of the film. So although there has perhaps been a sense that at one stage, the end of apartheid was too late for Sandra because she hadn't been able to heal her own wounds. In actual fact, that healing process has happened in parallel with the country's healing process. And it's one of the fascinating things about this story that so many of the events in her life echo perfectly the changes that have taken place in that country. That also applies to her own rehabilitation. There is no question that Sandra's story is bigger than she is, as it were. It is another reason why I felt that there was a good justification for dramatizing the story rather than telling it as a straightforward documentary. One of the best ways to teach people about big subjects is by looking at the individual and by drawing them into a personal story. I felt that Sandra's story was an extraordinary personal story which said enormous things about ourselves as a society, about racism, about the ways in which we exclude people for reasons that are completely arbitrary. Sam Neill, who plays Abram Lang, Sandra's father in the story, said a wonderful thing. He was asked why the title Skin? What does skin actually mean? And he said, as far as I'm concerned, skin is just another human organ, like the liver or the kidney. And I would no more judge somebody on the basis of what their kidney looks like than I would on the color of their skin. So in that sense, it's a very good metaphor for why the color of your skin is irrelevant in terms of differences between people. A slightly less sophisticated version of that is simply this idea that if you can have people of different races within one family, how can you make a distinction between those people?
Well, about South Africa, and I suppose this is the backdrop, and I was alluding to the question earlier on, is that the landscape, and bearing in mind I haven't seen the film, so I'm just going with this, but it strikes me as an obvious question, really, is that in any kind of film set in a kind of an epic landscape, if you like, that landscape becomes a character or becomes a feature of the film. Can you talk a little bit, explain if that's the case and why that's the case? And secondly, did you use it in some sort of symbolic way about describing South Africa in the past or its beauty and its future?
The story of Sandra Lang is, on the one hand, a small personal family drama, and on the other hand, it's also an epic story because it spans 30 years, the last 30 years of apartheid. As a filmmaker, I had to try and find, on a very limited budget, a way of suggesting epic. And the landscape of South Africa, which is ancient and magnificent and vast, suggests epic in a very straightforward way. So we often in the film feature the landscape in terms of the story and in terms of the journey that Sandra goes on. So when Sandra leaves home for the first time, we rise up, big crane shot, and see the landscape that she inhabits and that she is departing, the cozy homestead that she lives in, the small holding. And she's out into a much bigger world. So that's one instance in which the landscape is being used to suggest that size, that scale. There are other moments where she decides to leave her husband. And again, we sense the vastness of where she's going. There's a moment when Sandra and Petrus, the man she has fallen in love with, are forcibly removed from the homeland where they have lived and where his family has lived for generations. And the dispossessed families that leave that homeland are then set against a vast landscape. And again, that is a way that the landscape can be used to suggest epic. You've got these tiny little figures against these enormous mountains and these vast plains. And the other way that the landscape works as a metaphor within the film is that at the very beginning of the film, we have a couple of brief titles that explain some very simple things about apartheid. It was a system that divided people according to race, and it meant that people could not live under the same roof or enter the same shop or have the same job as each other. And I chose to set this title not against black, as perhaps might have been a choice, but against the vast South African landscape, because this is what they were all fighting about. This is what this land, this ancient land, is what was under dispute. And it's very, very beautiful. Those images are very beautiful, and that landscape is extremely beautiful. And you can understand, in a sense, why they're fighting. At the same time, it's very serene, and it's very, very ancient. So you have a sense of continuity over a long period of time. So whatever is happening today in terms of the political situation, that landscape preceded that political situation, and it will probably outlive that political situation. So that is another way in which the landscape is used metaphorically.
The next question, I thought this was a really not an obvious question, but I think it sort of deserves a bit of a, maybe a bigger picture as well about the landscape of apartheid and South Africa now, is that why tell the story now?
A lot of people over the years ask me, why are you telling a story about apartheid today? Apartheid ended 14 years ago. Surely it's irrelevant. It's extraordinary to me how quickly people forget. And it's very, very important that we are reminded of the wrongs of the past so that we are not repeating them in the future. This is a lesson that we've learned with films like Schindler's List, films that deal with the Holocaust. Now there are films that are talking about the Stasi in Eastern Germany. And I think it's very important with historical wrongs that they be kept at the forefront, that we never forget what happened. And it's extremely interesting in South Africa today that a whole generation has grown up without apartheid, and they really have no idea what it was like. And the useful thing about a film like Skin is that it draws you into the situation of apartheid without it being either a lecture or about an important activist or historical figure. It's about an ordinary person and the impact that apartheid had on that person's life, or indeed that family's life. And in that sense, it becomes a more personal experience to watch the film and to understand history through that personal connection.
How do you get over the idea of a bigger picture and the sort of political polemic, if you like, whether it's a small p or a large p, within a kind of small tale, independent, individual tale of someone's life?
I believe that through the specific, you get to the general. So if you tell a very specific story about somebody, it enables you to talk about much bigger subjects. And a story like this happened to have the elements that were automatically, intrinsically political. So you don't have to deal with the politics in a direct, in-your-face kind of way. The politics are actually inherent in the story. And what was clear to me from this story was that it nailed all of the anomalies of the apartheid system through the story of somebody who was in some ways removed from those politics. We have a few events in the film that place us politically in terms of where we are in the history of apartheid, because things changed dramatically in the last 30 years. So, for instance, we have a scene roughly halfway through the film where Sandra goes back to the Home Affairs office because she's had a child. That child looks black, but she is still officially classified white. And under the legal system of apartheid, she's not allowed to keep her coloured child unless she reclassifies herself coloured. So she goes back to the Home Affairs office, which classified her coloured in the first place before she was classified white. And suddenly there's a demonstration on the steps of the Home Office because it's the mid-70s, and suddenly there was a rising tide against apartheid, which hadn't existed before. And she has to move through that crowd in order to get to the bureaucrat. So it's happening around her. She's not in the demonstration. She's not part of the demonstration. But that demonstration nevertheless roots us in time. There's another event, which is Sandra and Petrus, the man she falls in love with, are forcibly removed from their homeland because the local authorities have found coal in that area. And so within a matter of days, the bulldozers are in and their homes are destroyed and they're put out somewhere else a homeland with nothing, and they have to start their lives again. This is clearly a very political event. Sandra and Pietras were the victims of that system without actually being inside of that system. One of the interesting things about apartheid was that, and indeed the struggle against apartheid, was that it was something that tended to happen within the big cities rather than in the rural areas. And one of the reasons that Sandra was not directly involved in politics, nor were her parents, although, of course, they were aware of the system and were supporters of that system, is that they were in the rural areas where they were not directly affected by things like demonstrations. And you often hear from people, white people, who lived during apartheid, that they weren't aware of what was happening. This is an argument that is also made by German people during the Nazi era. And there's a lot of skepticism about, you know, whether they could or couldn't have known what was happening. But it's true to say that it wasn't until Sandra came into contact with larger urban environments that she brushed up against the system.
That's a very good analogy, actually. I think that's true of today. You know, something could be happening around the corner and you wouldn't know about it. It doesn't mean you're actually complicit to it. I'd just like to talk about the script for a second, actually. In that, from what I can gather, the script, well, like any script, obviously evolves, clearly, but there must have been some specific decisions along the line, because apparently, even though the final version starts, you know, during the 94 elections and that sort of thing, at what point were changes motivated? Was it by you finding out new things, you know, as you came to be involved in that? And can you explain a little bit about the evolution of the script?
The screenplay for Skin took a very long time to develop because it's a hugely complex subject, and one wanted to be able to treat it with subtlety and with richness and complexity, and do it justice as well. And in a sense, it's like creating a sculpture, and you start with the clay, the raw material, and you begin to shape it. Very quickly, you can see it take some kind of form as a something recognizable. But to actually make it really fine can take a lot of chipping away and a lot of rethinking of that sculpture. And that certainly was the case with this script. The process that I went through, I'm British and I didn't know very much about South Africa when I first came across this story. So I felt it was very important to have a South African writer on board from the beginning who could tell the story from the inside. Rather naively, I didn't realize that being South African wasn't enough, because within South Africa, there are so many different groups and so many different cultures. So for instance, even within the white community, you have Afrikaners, you have Christians, you have Jews, you have people of different backgrounds whose perception of this story would have been very different. I chose a writer called Helena Creel, who is based in Hollywood but born in South Africa, in Johannesburg, from a white liberal family, whose knowledge of what it was to be an Afrikaner was in some senses at one remove. And I didn't realize until the first or second draft, and I'd had some response from people in South Africa, that there was further digging to do within the Afrikaans culture that we perhaps hadn't done justice to. Then there are other cultures which are represented in the film, the Zulu culture, the Swazi culture, which also needed to be done justice to. And after a few drafts of the script, and in fact we had other writers who had a go, if you like, at telling the story, I decided to take what we had and, in a way, test the material through a workshop process. So I went to Johannesburg in May 2004 and spent a week casting actors who would then improvise elements of the script as well as testing the scenes within the script. And we spent 2 weeks workshopping. We had three actors who played Abraham Lang. We had three actresses who played Sunny Lang, three who played Sandra. So different people who were of the background of the characters, each of whom was able to bring some new insight into those roles. And this was a very privileged thing to be able to do. We had funding from the UK Film Council, which allowed us to do that. And it really moved the script on tremendously. So in terms of an important stage that pushed us to another level, I would say those workshops were very, very important. And in fact, I took over the script at that point and used all the material from the workshops to reshape the script. And that's when some of those structural changes occurred. The other thing that can happen with a script is that there is a casting process that begins once you feel your script is ready. And in order to finance your film, you need to get actors of a certain level. Some of those actors will also request changes or need changes. So there are other changes that can occur to a script through that process.
Can you explain a little bit about, you know, where you decided to end the story and why? Because obviously, whatever happens at the end, it's the next chapter in her own life.
Yeah. When you're telling the story of a person who's still living, you have to make a decision as to where your story, your dramatization, is going to end. Many people, when I first went to South Africa, many people asked me, why was I telling this story now? Why was this the moment to tell this story? And why hadn't it been told as a feature film before? And I felt quite strongly that the emotional climax of this story and the moment that really enabled Sandra to move on in her life and to start the process of healing was the reconciliation with her mother, which occurred after a separation of 27 years. And that reconciliation had only just happened at the time that I first heard the story. So for me, and certainly listening very carefully to what Sandra herself had to say about her life, I felt that that moment of reconciliation was the watershed, which was the conclusion of the story. The things that happened subsequently are, of course, important and also part of the healing process. But with a drama, the golden rule is to find your climax and to exit fairly quickly after that. And if people want to know what happened to Sandra subsequently, they can read the book. Perhaps there will be another film to make about her in 20 years' time. I don't know where her story will take her. But that's the ending that I felt was appropriate to the story that I wanted to tell.
Can you say a little bit about the casting process for you? What decisions? Did you have people in mind, or did you have types in mind? And just explain that.
The casting process happens on two levels. The first level is the financing level, which is that the way films are financed today, particularly even small independent films like this, is that you need a certain level of cast to attract money. And so the first thing that we looked at was who were the actors who can attract finance who might be suitable for these characters, these roles. And what I was looking at was not only can they bring the money in, but can they actually handle the demands of the roles? Because they are quite complex roles, and they also demanded an ability to speak with a South African accent, which unfortunately, very few South African actors have any kind of box office value. In fact, the only actress in the world today is Charlize Theron, and she would have been the wrong colour to play Sandra, and certainly too young to play her mother. So we really had to look at international actors who I believed would be capable of being convincing as Afrikaners. And there are many actors who are wonderful actors, but who are known not to be good at accents, and we had to rule those out straight away. I wasn't that concerned about people who bore a strong physical resemblance to the real characters, because after all, we're making a movie, and I think that people in the cinema tend to be more beautiful, glamorous, and that's part of why we like to look at them for a couple of hours. And I wasn't making a documentary, so I felt it was acceptable to not glamorize them so much as perhaps choose people who were pleasing to look at least to some extent. Again, that was a personal aesthetic choice. Somebody else might have made a completely different choice. We went through a very long casting process for this first level, that I'm describing, which is to do with trying to raise the money. And one of the problems is that our main character was black. And there are very few black actors who can really, again, raise finance. Halle Berry is an obvious person, but she's somebody who, much as I admire as an actor, I didn't feel would be convincing as a South African. There are other actors, really very few, we could have considered. But luckily, Sofia Konedo had just been nominated for an Oscar for Hotel Rwanda. And she has really an extraordinary quality because she can look extremely young and also, but is actually an actress in her 30s. And the character spans 20 years. This is another huge challenge that we faced within the casting of the film for the main roles, is that some of them, the mother spans 30 years. The father spans 20 years. The adult Sandra spans 20 years. So you need to be able to cast actors who can play both the younger and the older characters. And I felt that Sophie had really a unique quality of being able to look convincingly 17 and 37. Simply both physically but also through acting the age. And we were immensely lucky that in a period where she was greatly in demand shortly after her Oscar nomination for Hotel Rwanda, she immediately took to the script. She could understand and empathize with the character and really bring the character to life. So Sophie was the first actor to come on board in terms of our finance plan. The parents proved more difficult because we were looking at actors who had to span between mid-40s to mid-60s, or in one case, up to 70, which we knew we would do through makeup, special effects. But nevertheless, it had to be convincing within the age range. And actors of that age tend to be either less box office, or if they are box office, they won't want to play the second leads. They'll want to play the main lead. So this is a huge challenge for a filmmaker when you have roles that you need to cast with stars and you don't have a vast amount of money to offer them. There are, as I said, two levels of casting. One is the financing, and the second is all the little roles, the second roles, the supporting roles in the film. And for those, I was absolutely determined to cast South African actors. There are, in fact, 77 speaking parts in this film, so that was a big challenge for us. And there isn't the level of experience amongst the acting talent pool out in South Africa that we're used to here. So the process of finding actors was like mining for gold. And I was very lucky that I was able to do my casting in South Africa in three different stages. The first stage was when I did the workshops, the script development workshops, which allowed us to improve the script. The second stage was we were given finance by the UK Film Council to make a pilot for the film, which was a few scenes from the movie, which would give a sense of the style and flavor of the film. And there was quite an extensive casting process for that, and we were able to find the little girl who ended up playing young Sandra in the film. And that was one of the goals of the pilot as well. And then the third bite of the cherry was when we came to make the film itself, where I had an additional 3 weeks of casting. But there were people from the workshops, people from the pilot, and people from the final casting process who all came on board.
Thank you. like I say, the next two are a sort of wearing different hats, really. One is about the sort of finances, really. I just wonder if you can give a sort of not brief overview, but obviously you can't go into every nugget. And we talked before about the fact you can't, or maybe don't want to say, this is how much it cost, or you know, direct things. But can you explain a little bit about the process of financing this movie?
Skin is an independent film, which means that it wasn't financed by a studio. It wasn't financed by a large film funding body. And the way that independent films are financed today is quite complex. So the first stage is to put a package together, which is the director, the stars, and the script. We had a very strong script. We had a first-time feature director, which makes things difficult to finance. And we had a long process of acquiring the sort of stars that would attract finance. And although we had wonderful actors, Sofia Canedo, Sam Neill, Alice Krieger, they were not Julia Roberts. So we weren't in the league of being able to attract lots of money very easily. What happens once you have that package is that you need to find a sales agent, which is the person who's going to sell your film around the world. Because the way that financiers recoup their finance once they've made an investment is to sell the film territory by territory, country by country around the world. And a sales agent is responsible for selling your film to each country around the world. The first thing the sales agent does is to look at your package and to determine what its value is in the marketplace. So he produces something that's called a set of sales estimates. And that really is what determines your budget. Because if he comes back and tells you that your film is worth £5 million in the marketplace, you can aim to raise £5 million from investors who will trust that figure. If he tells you your film is only worth £1 million, you will struggle to raise more than that. And it makes the process very difficult because a film like Skin, which spans 30 years, which has 77 speaking parts, which had thousands of extras and costumes and sets, was not going to be a cheap film to make. So it was very important that the sales estimates in some way helped justify the budget that was going to be necessary. We couldn't go out there with a DV cam or a mini DV camera and shoot the film. It had to be shot on a certain level with a certain sense of scale. So those sales estimates are terribly important to the process. And at the same time, they are simply an estimate. Nobody really knows what your film will ultimately make in the marketplace. Those sales estimates are arrived at by what other films like that with those kinds of actors might have achieved in the past. And the truth is that your film might make a great deal more money than those estimates reflect, or a great deal less. And so for the investors, it's always a risk coming in. But they're the only measure, however blunt an instrument, they're the only measure that investors have.
This leads on from the financial question. It's about pitching the film.
Mm-hmm.
When you were going in to sort of sell the film to mm-hmm. a sales agent and therefore, can you just explain the process of pitching the film and, as a case study, how you would have pitched this film?
When you're raising money for a film, you always need to have a pitch. You need to have, generally speaking, one or two sentences that will encapsulate your story and spark people's interest. People with money are very busy and they don't have time for you to sit there for hours explaining every nuance of your story. So you have to be able to be very, very concise and, as I say, intriguing, immediately intriguing. I was very lucky with Skin because it had a story that was quite a straightforward pitch in a sense. And the pitch that I used was: black girl born to two white Afrikaners in apartheid South Africa. That immediately produced a set of questions. What do you mean, born to the parents? Was she their biological daughter? The answer was yes. The parents were both white, but somewhere in their ancestry, there must have been black blood, and she was what's more commonly known as a throwback. So this very simple one-line pitch produced a set of questions that I could then answer in terms of the story, because the story spirals out from that single sentence. And it's very important, whatever your story, that you can encapsulate it in that way.
Like any film, if it's not only if it's kind of useful in terms of a sort of cinematic record, you know, certain films will go down as sort of classics of cinema. Some films might not be considered that, but will have a shelf life way beyond its own cinematic release. And I suspect that Skin, if not the first, and who's to say, but certainly in terms of the second thing, will have a greater impact, you know, the greater sum of its parts. Do you think, or can you comment a little bit on what you think the sort of future of Skin, whether it's an educational tool or a sort of social impact, either here or certainly in South Africa, will have?
One of the things that attracted me to this subject matter was that I felt it was something that would have resonance and that would endure over a long period of time. It had something to say. I enjoy cinema. I enjoy being entertained just like anyone else. But in terms of the films that I want to make films that people think about afterwards and that have a value. They take such a long time to make and it's such an immense effort that you want them to have some kind of lasting value. And the way that cinema distribution is working these days, films are not given a great deal of time actually on the screens. You'll notice in Britain in particular that the average film will only last a few weeks at most, which means that they have to have a life beyond that. Now, we also live in a very exciting world where there is something called video on demand, where you can download whatever film you want to see whenever you want to see it. And that is increasingly a form of distribution that we will be seeing through the internet or by other means. There's DVDs and there are airlines and other forms of distribution. In terms of the long-term life of the film, I believe that it has very important things to say that are extremely topical today, to do with racism and exclusion. We only have to look at our obsession with terrorism and otherness to see that Skin has things to say to us about how to get on as people, whatever we look like, whatever our color. We only have to look at the US elections right now with Barack Obama to see that race is an issue that perhaps isn't discussed directly, but is very much there. And I think if America does end up with a black president, issues of race will continue to be discussed. So I think that Skin, which attempts to discuss race in a subtle way, but also blows the cover of racial difference, is a film that will be able to be used as an example again and again through the school system, through the university system, and people will be fascinated by this story for many, many years. Indeed, Sandra's story has already been of great media interest for the last 40 years, since she was expelled from school in 1965, and I think will continue to be of interest for many decades to come.
A very brief question then. In terms of, you know, given the fact that you'd worked in opera and that you were a documentary filmmaker, as we know, obviously, but coming to filmmaking perhaps from another discipline, but working within the South African context, has that made a difference and how is it?
I went to UCLA Film School when I was quite young. I was only 17 when I started there. And to be a film director, you really need to have a lot of experience from lots of different areas. And you need to be able to know a little bit about an awful lot. When I graduated from film school, I came back to Britain, and there wasn't much of a film industry going on here. It was the late 1980s, and the video filmmaking revolution hadn't really happened yet, so it was still quite expensive to make films. I knew that I wanted to get more directing experience, and I thought that the theatre was perhaps one way of doing that. And rather than going into the straight theatre, I went into the opera world because I also have an interest in music and classical music. And I spent many years working as an assistant director and then a director in the opera world. And I think it's of great benefit to come from different disciplines other than just focusing on film, because each thing that you know about brings something to your work. And for me, music is a very important part of film. I love cross-pollinating between different disciplines, whether it's dance or music or theatre, and having all of those things coexist within a film. The score of Skin was something that was very important for me to get right, and that it also had to express something about Sandra's journey. And what we decided to do was to create a score that was a hybrid of Western and African sounds. So we essentially took a Western scoring approach, traditional Western score approach, but our orchestration, the instruments that we chose to use within the score, are very largely African. So we use a string instrument called a kora, which is a little bit like a primitive guitar, very difficult to tune and to play. It's like a drum with strings along a very long spine. And we used antelope horn instead of flute, for instance. And we used lots of drums and marimba. So although the score can seem like a traditional Western score, its instrumentation gives it a completely different color. And in particular, the use of percussion in the film is extremely African. So at different times, we use different sorts of sounds, sometimes more African, sometimes more Western, depending on what's happening in the story. And the final element that is also part of the score is choral, because the South African musical tradition is very much a choral tradition. So I felt it was important that the film sounded authentically South African, because that's where it was set, but at the same time that the music was used to enhance the emotional experience, just as it does in any movie.
The sequences that you creating historic sequences must be expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the music, then you've got the talent. Do you think you could sort of supplement that just about, without going into specifics, that cost 20 grand and that was 50 grand or
right,
that was a million,
okay.
Or, but just specifically
sure,
about the finances. Just
on the one hand, we were telling a personal story, and there are many intimate scenes in the film which simply involve two or three characters in a room. At the same time, we were trying to create something that had epic scale. And there were scenes in the film that were big set pieces, if you like, that would give it that scale. The two that really stand out for me are we had to recreate the first free elections in Johannesburg in 1994. This is the first time that everyone in the country was allowed a democratic vote. And what happened often in the townships was that a field, whether it was a playing field or a football field, was taken over with polling stations. And people, there was a queue that snaked from the polling station for a very long way. And there are some wonderful images, documentary images, that one can see of that. It's quite amazing how many people it takes to actually make that kind of scene convincing. We had a limited budget, so we could only afford about 1,000 extras for that scene. But to marshal 1,000 people and, you know, put them in a snake and get them to act and do what they need to do was quite a business. And not only was there the queue of snaking people, there were people who were selling lollipops or handing out voting forms or, you know, always involved in and around the queue of voters. So that was one of our really huge scenes. And we had to keep a very close eye on the weather because we happened to be there in the rainy season, which was a bit unfortunate. The rainy season had decided to come a couple of months early. And you don't want to call 1,000 people and then be rained off because you then have to call them again. So we had actually scheduled the first free elections for a day and then paid for quite a sophisticated weather forecast 3 days before and found out that it was going to rain on that day. So we pushed it back by a couple of days and we had glorious sunshine and we were able to shoot the scene. The second scene that was extremely complex and expensive to make was the forced removal when Sandra and Petrus are removed from their homeland. And that involved destroying a lot of properties, tin shacks. It involved several hundred extras. It involved special effects smoke, huge bulldozers, stuntman, a special effects house that belonged to Sandra and Petrus that had to collapse and that we then had to rebuild and start again. So that was, in a sense, the most daunting scene of all for me as a first-time filmmaker to do. And luckily, we had the right team of people that enabled us to do it.